Welcome to democracyandthemove.org, a podcast tribute to the people and organizations dedicated to reimagining our nation and bringing it back to its true democratic principles. I'm Dan Schaefer, the producer of this podcast, and thank you for joining us today. Last week, we talked with Vermont State Senator Christopher Pearson about an organization known as the National Popular Vote. It was a very informative interview where we discussed the possibility of essentially canceling the effects of the Electoral College. If you've since taken a look at our website at democracyandthemove.org, you might have noticed that we placed a clickable image of the logo for National Popular Vote right there on the homepage. And if you click on it, you will be taken to the National Popular Vote website. Also, you'll notice that we posted a transcript for the conversation on our website blog page. If you or any organization you're a part of wants to get similar airtime on our podcast, along with a link on our front page, please contact us at info@democracyonthemove.org or on our website at democracyonthemove.org/contact. We do not have any guests this week. I think everybody is busy with the Thanksgiving holiday, but because we have committed ourselves to a weekly podcast, we'll just go without the guests this time around and instead talk about our plans for upcoming episodes. Our first topic is the Electoral College. If you recall, last week we talked about the Electoral College and its detrimental effect on our democracy. As Senator Pearson pointed out, this year's election wasn't even close. That is, when you talk about the popular vote, it really wasn't much of a contest. As of this recording on Saturday, November 28th, the state of New York is still counting votes, but so far we see that Biden received over 6 million more votes than Trump. No doubt, both men scored big on the count of absolute numbers. Biden surpassed 80 million votes, and Trump is closing in on 74 million votes. It was indeed an impressive election in terms of the overall vote count, but here's the thing. As Senator Pearson pointed out, that 6+ million vote margin didn't mean a thing, really. Why? Because it all hinged on 46,000 votes from Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia. So it could have easily gone the other direction, granting Trump a victory even though he would have lost the popular vote by over twice the margin as in the 2016 election. Now, how could this be? Well, welcome to the Electoral College. It's just the way that we throw our electors into a winner-take-all pool. It's somewhat insane when you think about it. And there's more. Check this out. Nearly 6 million votes went for Trump in California, but it didn't make a difference, did it? If you're a Republican in California, it would seem pointless to vote for a Republican president. All of your 55 electoral votes are going to go for the Democrats, no matter what. California is a solid blue state, so your vote is meaningless. Now, there's a similar story in Texas. Roughly 5.2 million votes were cast for Biden, yet all 38 electoral votes went for Trump. It's as if being a Republican in California or being a Democrat in Texas makes you invisible. Here's another interesting fact. If you're living in California and you want to vote multiple times for president, you can do it. Legally. Really. All you have to do is move to Wyoming. Your presidential vote in Wyoming is worth roughly 3.7 presidential votes in California. This is because Wyoming gets 3 electoral votes. Now, every state gets a guaranteed minimum of 3. That's 3 electoral votes spread over a total population of roughly 580,000 people. Whereas in California, there's a population of roughly 39.5 million who have only a total of 55 electoral votes. So, work out the math. You're worth 3.7 times as much to the president if you live in Wyoming. Now, to be fair, there are some arguments for sustaining the Electoral College. The main argument being this. In theory, the Electoral College keeps the more populous states from imposing their will on the less populous states. I'm personally not sure I agree with that argument, however, because in reality, almost the opposite becomes true. That is, it generally comes down to one state, or perhaps a small group of states, that often get put into the fulcrum position. In our most recent election, for example, we spent the better part of a week waiting for the 46,000 votes from Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia to confirm what 6+ million other votes already did. It just so happened that these 46,000 votes swung in favor of the popular vote, but there was nothing to ensure that it turned out that way. It could have gone the other way just as easily. Each vote in these fulcrum states became far more valuable than any vote in the more populous states. I mean, people don't even bother waiting for California or New York to complete any degree of vote counting. These states pretty much get called right away. That just doesn't seem fair. It's not fair to the Republicans in California. It's not fair to the Democrats in Texas. Speaking about the fulcrum position, primary elections in this country do more to select our leaders than do the actual elections. This is especially true in races for the House of Representatives, but it also applies to presidential elections. Now, there's a lot to discuss here, but I'm just going to provide a few of the highlights. Subsequent episodes in this podcast will focus on the details. I'll start by providing an interesting observation about our language. The word primary is often used as a verb, that is, a word that takes action. As in, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out-primaried Joe Crowley, a 10-term Democratic incumbent. Now, you might think this is a one-off event, that's not likely to be repeated. Well, it turns out that's not the case. It's happening more and more. In St. Louis, for example, Cori Bush out-primaried another 10-term incumbent, Lacey Clay. We've seen similar action in the Republican Party as well. We've seen established incumbents getting out-primaried by more extremist contenders, generally from the Tea Party. And in a majority of these out-primaried cases, the candidate that wins the primary goes on to win the general election, mainly because the district is fixed through a process known as gerrymandering. We'll talk more about gerrymandering shortly, but suffice it to say that he or she who wins the primary in a highly gerrymandered district is highly likely to win the general election. Now, do you see the pattern here? Through a combination of primary elections and gerrymandered districts, one party moves to the left, the other party moves to the right, and over time, more and more people move away from the center, leaving a large vacuous space where compromise is no longer possible. And, as a result, Congress fills up with stubborn, non-compromising idealists and thus gets deadlocked. It would seem that there's something wrong in the primary process then, right? The problem is that, in general, the population doesn't pay as much attention to the primaries as it does to the general elections. So, to a large degree, those who get into Congress are those who win the primaries, thus giving the primary voter more control than the general election voter. And who are the people voting in these primaries? Well, history seems to indicate that it's the more motivated and, well, dare I say, the more extremist personalities that bother to go to the polls in the primary. Yes, everyone should vote in the primary, but in reality, it just doesn't work out that way. There are some very creative solutions being proposed to help solve this problem. Two of them are ranked choice voting and open top five primaries. Now, believe it or not, Alaska took a very progressive step in the most recent election. They voted to approve both those concepts, though they plan to implement top four instead of top five. Yeah, close enough. But what I'm trying to say is that perhaps people in Alaska are onto something that the rest of us ought to consider. In subsequent episodes of this podcast, we'll talk more about how we might fix the system of political primaries in this country. In the meantime, I personally recommend reading The Politics Industry by Catherine Gale and Michael Porter. They do a pretty good job of explaining the problem and propose both ranked choice voting and open top five primaries as potential solutions. Now, I mentioned gerrymandering just a short moment ago. Gerrymandering is an interesting term. gerrymandering is typically capitalized because the gerry part of gerrymandering is a proper noun. It refers to Governor and Vice President Elbridge Gerry. He was our nation's fifth vice president, serving under James Madison. He was also the ninth governor of Massachusetts. And he was a revolutionary patriot, having signed both the Declaration of Independence and the Articles of Confederation. Now, he held out and did not sign the Constitution because he felt it needed a Bill of Rights in order for him to do so. He eventually lobbied for and helped secure our Bill of Rights. So, why the term gerrymandering? It was probably by fluke that Elbridge Gerry is associated with that term. He was governor of Massachusetts when district lines were drawn for that state. Now, the lines were drawn in such a way as to favor his party, which was then called the Democratic Republican Party. The map was contorted in such a way as to look somewhat like a salamander. So, combine Gerry with salamander and you get gerrymander. These days, the practice of gerrymandering has become extremely prevalent, and unfortunately, the practice has survived a number of court challenges throughout the years, including challenges as high as the U.S. Supreme Court. Its effects on democracy have been undeniably profound. In a recent article by Carl Weiser of the Gannett News Service, out of 435 House seats, 64 members this year have no major party opponent, according to the Center for Voting and Democracy. About 300 or so face only token opposition, according to experts and House members. These districts have become largely non-competitive due to gerrymandering. It's common to hear gerrymandering as a method by which politicians pick their voters rather than the voters picking their politicians. An extreme example exists in the state of Wisconsin. In the 2018 elections, Democrats won 54% of all the votes for state assembly combined, yet Republicans took 63% of the seats. So how does gerrymandering work? Well, it uses the techniques of pack and crack to manipulate voter demographics. In the packing scenario, district lines are drawn that pack as many like-minded voters into one district as possible. This allows the voters to win the district, but the high concentration of voters leaves very few remaining outside the district to influence adjacent districts. In the cracking scenario, a district line is drawn down the middle of a naturally occurring concentration of like-minded voters, thereby splitting the area into two separate districts, where these voters now get diluted by opposing votes within each cracked district. Now, if this sounds complicated, well, it is, and these days, sophisticated computer algorithms and voter databases are used to help draw the district lines to favor one party over the other. Now, if this seems anti-democratic to you, well, join the club. So what can be done about it? Well, as a practical matter, it's really difficult to not bias a district in some way when drawing district lines. You'll never get complete consensus on the demographics. But there are other approaches. For example, you can create what's called a multi-winder district, where you combine two or more districts and allow the voters to choose more than one candidate. This tends to blur the lines a bit by allowing natural concentrations of like-minded voters to get fair representation. You may want to check out an organization known as FairVote for more information. We will talk with representatives from FairVote on future podcasts. Their website is fairvote.org. It's all one word, fairvote.org. Campaign finance is a really big issue to tackle, and we plan to devote a lot of our future podcast episodes to this concept. One of the more pivotal recent decisions handed down from the U.S. Supreme Court is something called Citizens United. In this 2010 decision, the Supreme Court said that the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment prohibits the government from restricting political communications paid for by corporations. In a sense, it equated the free speech individual rights to corporations, thus saying that corporations have the same rights as individuals. This opened up the floodgates of corporate dollars into the political campaigns as well as ballot issues. It was yet another step into a corporatocracy style of government. Since this was a Supreme Court decision, it's difficult to unwind this policy with ordinary laws. This leaves only one option, a constitutional amendment. In other words, it is understood that we need a constitutional amendment to say that corporations are not people. Now, I have to admit, that would seem obvious to a guy like me, and I suspect it would seem obvious to anyone, but it's interesting that we're nevertheless backed into a corner on this one, where we have to use a constitutional amendment to give definition to what exactly the Constitution applies to. Check out the organization known as Move to Amend at movetoamend.org. That's movetoamend.org. They've published a complete text to a proposed 28th Amendment, which they call the We the People Amendment. Within this amendment, they state, quote, "The rights protected by the Constitution of the United States are the rights of natural persons only." It goes on to say, quote, "Artificial entities established by the laws of any state, the United States, or any foreign state shall have no rights under this Constitution and are subject to regulation by the people through federal, state, or local law," unquote. Okay, I'm not a lawyer, I'm actually an engineer, but I am nevertheless depressed at the thought that we need an amendment to actually state the obvious. But it is felt that this amendment will unwind the Citizens United decision and make a big step toward eliminating the influence of corporate dollars on U.S. law and policy. We plan to have representatives from Move to Amend on an upcoming podcast. They should be able to provide more details on the problem and their solution, and I'll certainly have some challenging questions for them. There are many other issues to discuss on the road to a more perfect union. I've only talked about a few of them. This podcast episode is a sort of introduction to the types of issues we will cover over the foreseeable future. If you have any ideas for topics we can cover here at Democracy on the Move, please let us know by dropping us an email at info@democracyonthemove.org. Let us know the topic as well as the people and organizations involved so that we may make the necessary contacts and put together a dedicated episode. And that's it for this go-around. You've been listening to Democracy on the Move, a weekly tribute to all those people and organizations dedicated to keeping the spirit of democracy alive. Please tune in each week where we will feature stories and topics that will keep you informed on our continuing forward march toward a more perfect union. If you have any questions or suggestions for stories or people you think we should be covering at Democracy on the Move, please contact us through our website contact page at democracyonthemove.org/contact. That's all one word, by the way, Democracy on the Move. democracyonthemove.org/contact. Or send us an email at info@democracyonthemove.org. You can also comment on our Twitter page at All on the Move. Again, all one word, All on the Move. Or you can comment on our Facebook page at Democracy on the Move. If you find today's podcast interesting and informative, please tell your friends and family about us. And if you would like to help sponsor the podcast at Democracy on the Move, please contact us through the website or email. I'm Dan Schaefer, producer of the podcast, and I'd like to thank you for tuning in. It's been my pleasure to be with you today. Please have a safe week ahead, and we hope you'll tune in to our next show.